You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by United Steelworkers District 11 and Teamsters Joint Council 56. United Steelworkers District 11, representing 35,000 members in the Midwest, protecting workers' rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. And Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in Western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, Mike Stout, former grievance chair of Steelworkers Local 1397, chronicles the closing of the Homestead Steel Mill in a book which can be a manual for resisting plant closings. Then we pay tribute to the great leader who Martin Luther King called the leading theorist and strategist of a nonviolent world, Reverend James Lawson, who called himself a Jesus-oriented activist. Historian Michael Honey has a film about Lawson called Love and Solidarity. In the news, Biden orders an OSHA standard to protect workers from COVID, and Amazon workers in Alabama file for union election. Our feature at the end of the show is Washington Window on Workers with Mark Grunberg. We'll ask him whether we'll get a new $15 minimum wage. Now for the news. And now for the news from our side, January 28th, 2021. The Financial Express from Bangladesh reports that lower middle-income countries witnessed the highest decline in working hours in 2020 as COVID-19 caused unprecedented disruptions to the world of work, according to the report of the International Labor Organization. An estimated 11.3% of working hours were lost in these countries compared to the pre-crisis baseline in late 2019. Half the loss of working hours occurred between April and June of 2020. It was lower middle-income countries which had the greatest losses in working hours, far above the global average of 8.8%. This was overwhelmingly driven by the stronger impact of the crisis in these countries in the second quarter, 29% work hour losses compared to 18.2% global average. These losses are accounted for either by reduced work hours for those employed or unprecedented levels of employment loss, hitting 114 million people. Such massive losses resulted in 8.3% decline in global labor income before support measures are included. Women have been more affected than men by the pandemic's labor market disruptions.
In particular, women are much more likely than men to drop out of the labor market and become inactive.
On January 21st, 2021, President Biden signed an executive order requiring OSHA to develop a COVID-19 workplace emergency temporary standard by mid-March. It's called the Executive Order on Protecting Worker Health and Safety. It specifically said mask wearing in the workplace may be required. During the Trump administration, OSHA was essentially missing in action. Its guidance was not binding on employers, and it stood by while hundreds of workers succumbed to the virus unprotected. The new order directs the Secretary of Labor to issue guidance to employers on workplace safety within 2 weeks. Consider whether we need an emergency temporary standard on COVID by March 15th, including mandatory mask in the workplace. Review enforcement, make changes, and launch a national multilingual campaign aimed at enforcement that would protect workers from retaliation for turning in their employers. On January 22nd, AFL-CIO President Richard Tremka joined Bloomberg Radio's David Westin to discuss Biden's executive order requiring the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and the Mine Safety and Health Administration to issue emergency standards to protect workers from COVID-19. Here's Tremka.
And we've been saying this for months. I've been saying this on your show, that we need an emergency standard. And the president has done an executive order mandating a standard for OSHA and for MSHA.
Yeah, take us through that, because you and I have talked that in the past. This is something different than what Mr. Deese was talking about. But it appears the president has ordered OSHA to come up with a standard now.
He has, and MSHA as well. Both of them will have to come up with an emergency pandemic standard that is geared towards this pandemic and protecting the workers in this pandemic. There was an issue. What if somebody doesn't comply with that? What happens? They've just made that clear with this executive order that if they don't comply and you are in a dangerous situation, you can remove yourself without losing pay. Now, that's a tremendous leverage for workers to have to be able to get a safe workplace. It's also common sense that you shouldn't have to work in unsafe conditions, whether you have a union or you don't have a union. Because most of our units, David, with the union, we have that provision where you can withdraw from an unsafe condition. But now all workers can. And I applaud the president for doing this, because it will protect the health and safety, particularly the health of those frontline workers, the essential workers that we talk about. And it'll form, I think, a stronger partnership between employers and employees to fight this pandemic and make sure everybody is safe in the process.
Richard, how long is that going to take? I mean, rulemaking takes a fair amount of time in Washington. This is an emergency standard. Is there some expedited way to get this in effect? When's it going to protect people?
It's already done. The standard's done. All they have to do is implement it. OSHA will implement it very, very quickly. It'll be in place. But this executive order giving workers the right to withdraw will take effect immediately. And so a worker who is unable to or has an unsafe work condition can say no. The regulations that'll follow, but I think it'll be effective now. That's important because it'll force employers, recalcitrant employers that really didn't care about the health and safety of their workers, to rethink that process.
Amazon warehouse workers are organizing in Alabama. The drive began last summer near Birmingham when a group of workers from the Bessemer Fulfillment Center met secretly with an organizer from the Retail, Wholesale, Department Store Union, otherwise known as the RWDSU. It seems that constant surveillance of employee productivity was their main motive to organize. Since that clandestine meeting, the workers worked nonstop and by December had gathered over 2,000 signature cards asking for RWDSU to represent them. The National Labor Relations Board then scheduled a union election for the 5,800 workers and just announced that mail-in voting will start next month and continue through the end of March. Many of the workers are Black, and Black Lives Matter figures importantly in the union campaign. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel and myself, Chris Mann.
The count is down, the devil's in town, he's getting us one by one. We're losing ground, we're going down, each off on our own. Sparks will fly, good people will die, it's dark before the dawn. The fire will burn till we finally learn the way to right this wrong. Gonna change the paradigm. On the streets and picket lines. Every craft and every trade. Break the chain, there's a world to gain. Man the barricades. As long as people of color are shot down in the street. Some sister or some brother chained in poverty. As long as they fill the jails with tales of hell and misery. At the very least, there'll be no peace till we finally see. Black, white, blue, and red. Like the IWW said. Like a rainbow in the sky. Sound the bell, it's time to rebel. People, it's do or die. The water's bad, the cows are mad. Grim reapers everywhere. On the farms and city homes, breathing poison air. No place to run, no place to hide. Might as well get it right. The answer for this cancer is when we all unite. This planet's all we got. Let's give it our best shot. For a better world in birth. Hand in hand in every land. Protecting Mother Earth.
Welcome to the first segment of the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Chris Mann. Mike Stout wrote the song we've just heard, One Big Union. Mike is not only a musician, but a relentless union and social justice activist from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So we are glad to have him as our guest tonight. What do you do when technology changes and corporate greed slowly shut down the industry that you're working in? Our guest, Mike Stout, wrote the book, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years. This is the actual tale of Local 1397 and the fight for union democracy. And it tells us of the fight back of Local 1397 as a rank and file caucus at the Homestead Steel Mill in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Homestead was an epicenter of the era's rank-and-file revolt against union bureaucracies. Mike describes how the rank-and-file caucus used tactics ranging from a rank-and-file newspaper to member-involved grievance campaigns, union elections, rock concerts, unemployed committees, food banks, coalitions with community groups and environmental groups, occupations of corporate headquarters, work-ins, work stoppages, and work to rule. Just to set the scene, the United States Steel had 30,000 workers in seven mills in the Monongahela Valley in 1977, and only 3,000 workers remain 10 years later. Experts calculate that for each industrial job lost, five others in support jobs were also lost. Multiply that many times over beyond the Mon Valley and the steel sector and beyond the 1980s, which set the pattern for mass layoffs and taught the country to live with insecurity, homelessness, and household debt. Mike was a crane operator in Homestead Steelworks in a plant that has four main entrances and is 4 miles long. He later became grievance chair for the local, even serving after he was laid off. Welcome to the show, Mike. Can you briefly tell us about the significance of the mill that you worked in and the union historically?
Well, historically, the union originated out of the Amalgamation Association of Iron and Steel Workers back in the late 1880s. And by early 1890s, they represented the majority, if not all, of the craft workers at the Homestead Mill. And as crafts workers, maintenance workers, they pretty much controlled the entire workforce at Homestead. They believed in democracy. They believed in, they had a right to have a say in a lot of the things that unions and workers don't have a say in, whether it was investment rights, equipment, et cetera, et cetera. They imposed their self-discipline on the entire mill workforce, including those that weren't in the mill. And because of that, they were a direct threat to Andrew Carnegie and Henry Clay Frick and the people who ran the mill. The Battle of 1892 was one of the most famous battles in American history, worker struggles, where 700 Pinkertons attacked the town coming in on two boats, and the entire town rose up and resisted them. 10 people died. The entire Pinkerton, I'm sorry, it was 300 Pinkertons, were captured and held for 8 days until the National Guard state militia came and freed them and took back control of the town and crushed the Union. And the Union was crushed, but never went away. There was numerous attempts between 1892 and the 1920s to reestablish the amalgamated, which failed. Then, of course, the big strike came in 1919, when once again the unions tried to organize the steelworkers, this time the entire workforce, and once again it was crushed, not only by the government but by the iron and coal police and hired thugs and guns, and stayed that way until the 1930s and the New Deal, and once again the steelworkers rose up and formed the Steelworkers Organizing Committee, and the rest was history.
You write, most of all, this book is about steelworker local union is a working class hymn to democracy and solidarity, about the time when the bottom rose up to the brim, when the democracy was from below more than just words. Would you apply this statement to our current movements today, such as Black Lives Matter, that it is a rise from the bottom to the top?
Yes, that's exactly where all democratic movements come from. I've never seen a democratic movement in history that came from the top. It comes from the people that are affected and the people that are fighting in the trenches and the people that are in the workplaces. And that's certainly what happened at the Homestead Steel Mill in the mid-1970s.
So why did you write this book?
I wrote this book for three reasons. Number one, the vast majority of the population in the United States, including the majority of workers, have never been in a union, don't know anything about unions, and what they have heard about unions is utter BS. I think it was important to establish my personal history and direct history with unions inside a steel mill, and why unions were necessary then and why their unions are necessary today. And not only why unions are necessary, but what unions should look like. And by that, I mean, there's always been two forms out there. There's the business style unionism, and there's what we call democracy solidarity unionism. And when I entered the Homestead Mill, the situation was, it was a business union, and it was a very bad business union. They didn't even do their business right. That workers had virtually no representation, paid dues for nothing, and a small group of people got together and decided to do something about it.
So give us a flavor for your first work day when you...
Well, I felt two things. I felt something almost magical. I had read about, but I'd never been in an industrial setting that humongous. It was unbelievable. It was like almost like being, I describe it, an industrial fairy tale. I went and hired into the 100-inch plate mill and went into the slab yard between the two plate mills and the slab mill. And it was just, slabs were stacked up 40, 50 feet high all over the place. And it was just so big and so humongous. Cranes were 40 feet off the ground, lifting steel up, 200 tons of steel. And it was just magical. And you also had a sense, which I didn't the first day, but very quickly, that there was something about Homestead that was different than any workplace I had ever been in before. And quite frankly, the workers there in general, and their forms of resistance to the company in many ways were personal, often departmental. But that soon changed with the organization of the rank and file caucus in 1976.
Tell us about the newspaper, the plant-wide newspaper, the 1397 rank and file.
The newspaper, in my opinion, was to this day the most progressive democratic expression inside a union that I've ever seen or read about. And it was started by a young woman who was only 24 years old, named Michelle McMills. And back in the 1970s, she was in a man's world. She was in a macho man's steel world. And for a 24-year-old woman to go into that world and do what she accomplished, in my opinion, she was up there with Mother Jones. What she did is she assessed the mill, the situation, and got together with several other maintenance workers and decided to start a rank and file caucus and bring some democracy back to the union. And when they assessed the situation, they realized they were dealing with a steel mill that was 4 miles long, took up 330 acres, spanned two sides of a river, had four entrances to it, and that the only way they were going to be able to reach that many workers was to put out a newspaper. This was, of course, remember, for your readers, this was the pre-computer age. There was no such thing as home computers or anything remotely like that. Most information was spread by newspapers. And so she decided to put out a newspaper. When she put out the newspaper, she had an opening statement in it, and the statement said this to the membership. It was a letter addressed to the membership and said, this is your paper. This is your voice. This is democracy in action. You have a right and a part to participate in this, and your voice will be heard. And basically put out, said, anybody that wants to contribute to this newspaper, we don't care if it's a complaint about a boss, a complaint about a union, a poem, a song, a cartoon, whatever you want, this is your voice. And it was democracy in action.
So what about the plant plague section of the newspaper? What was that about?
The plant plague was started by our first union president and one of the founders of the rank and file caucus, Ron Wiesen, who is probably one of the most notorious radical rank and file steelworkers in history. He will go down. And the plant plague was started to allow any worker who had any complaint about any boss or management or the company to say whatever they wanted in that column. And basically what Ron would do is, he was a welder in central maintenance. So that means he went throughout the mill. Homestead Mill was literally 8 mills within one. We had a huge plate mills, 3. We had a slab mill. We had a structural mill. We had 2 different structural mills. We had a forging division. We had a metallurgical division. But Ronnie would get all over the mill. And when workers would give him complaints about people in management and the way they were being treated, he would collect it all, take it back. Michelle would write it up, and then they would put it in the plant plague section. And it gave workers an actual voice, not only a voice for them, but a voice to share with the other 8,000 workers in the mill and let them know that their problems were probably the same as the problems being expressed in the plant plague section.
So the momentum built both within and outside the rank and file caucus to the point where the caucus members ran for office and actually won. How was that? How did that feel?
Empowering. There was a series of events happened. Ron Wiesen, Michelle McMills, and John Ingersoll, and another welder got elected to the 1976 convention, Steelworkers Convention in Las Vegas. They met Ed Sadlowski and the Fight Back campaign, which was a rank and file caucus nationally inside the Steelworkers Union. And they came back and formed the caucus. And after a series of victories, including a victory in the Central Maintenance Department, where the company decided that they had overpaid the workers almost $400,000, and they were going to take that out of their paychecks, which that was a lot of money back in 1977. And the union refused to take the case up, the local union. They said, you have a loser, we're not going to represent you. So the Steelworker Caucus organized the central maintenance employees, had several meetings with over 200 people at the union hall, and then approached the district union and said, you either file a lawsuit on our behalf or we will go outside and get our own lawyer. And so they fought the case when the local union wouldn't. They won the case in arbitration. And from that point on, it was grow, grow, grow. Everybody in the mill saw who stood with the workers and who didn't. By 1978, the writing was on the wall. At the International Convention held in Atlantic City, our entire rank and file slate was elected. And then in 1979, we swept into office 2-1.
So then when you got in office, you wrote a chapter on learning the ropes and how to handle power. What were the lessons you learned from having that power in the leadership of the union?
I started out as an assistant grievance man. I was appointed, then I was elected a zone grievance man. And that is the equivalent for a lot of you union people out there to a zone grievance man would be a chief steward. Zone grievance man, I was in charge of 2,000 workers representing from 4 different mills. And then on top of that, later on, I became chairman of the grievance committee and was in charge of the whole mill. And I learned early on that I was in a unique position, not only to fight for workers' rights, but to involve workers themselves in that fight. So I went out of my way to let the workers know 2 things. Number one, I'm going to represent you and I'm going to do my job and I don't care and give 2 diddly squats what you think about me. I don't care what you call me. I don't care what your impression is. I'm going to represent you just as hard as somebody that's my friend. That was number one. And number two, I made sure that at every step of the grievance procedure and every single fight, that the worker was there at the table with fighting the fight. So I didn't go in as some hotshot lawyer behind the closed doors and cut deals and discuss somebody's case. I made sure that at every step of the grievance procedure, the worker was there with me. And the key to winning those grievances and winning those fights was involving the workers themselves in the battle.
Tell us then, what happened to the steel industry?
Everything went poorly because beginning in, I would say, roughly the late 1970s, but culminating in the 1980s, you had what you see today, which is the beginning of globalization of capitalism. And globalization of capitalism destroyed boundaries, destroyed nations, and distributed the workforce, chasing the highest rate of profit and chasing where the cheapest labor they could find was. And at that point, the heart of manufacturing in the United States was the steel industry and the coal mining industry. In the steel industry, they made roughly around 1977, 78, they were taken over by Wall Street financiers and bankers, including a CEO named David Roderick. And he put the word out. He says, we're out, we're a business. We're out to make money. We're not out to make steel. He says, that's a side thing. He says, we're going to chase the highest rate of profit. And he had a quote on the front of a November 1981 issue of Fortune magazine with a broken U.S. steel emblem that said, there are no more sacred cows. Meaning if your facility didn't make a rate of profit that they considered desirable, they were going to shut you down no matter what your history was, no matter what the commitment was and contributions of the workforces and the sacrifice made, they were going to shut it down. And at the same time, U.S. Steel major diversified out of steel into oil, into real estate, into all sorts of different ventures, and culminating, of course, in November 1981, they spent $6.4 billion buying Marathon Oil. And at the same time, they were complaining in this period using this buy American, the threat is real from foreign steel was just a bunch of bogus bullshit. U.S. Steel, in fact, was the major importer of foreign steel into the United States. And at the same time, they were investing in specialty steel mills in Italy, investing in Sumitomo Industries in Asia and in South America. Them and Mellon Bank invested through a Banco de Investimento, a bank in Rio de Janeiro, in a slab producing mill in the interior of Brazil to begin importing slabs into the United States, which put places like Homestead out of business. So that was the beginning of globalization and this whole shift in the United States from a manufacturing-based economy to a consumer-based economy, which is what we have today.
That's all the time we have for tonight. There's so much that that unionists can glean from this book written by Mike Stout, Homestead Steel Mill, The Final 10 Years, that we've asked Mike to return for a show in March. Stay tuned for Judy Ansel in the second half of the Heartland Labor Forum.
We'll believe in freedom cannot rest. You believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. We'll believe in freedom cannot rest. Hear me talking to you. We'll believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes. Until the killing of black men, mothers, sons, is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers, sons.
You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. This is Judy Ansel. It was about 20 years ago that I read David Halberstam's book, The Children, about the 1960s Nashville student movement and the activists like Diane Nash and John Lewis, who were the shock troops of the civil rights movement, sitting in at lunch counters, risking their lives in the freedom rides, forming the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Their trainer in nonviolence and mentor was James Lawson, a divinity student at Vanderbilt University who had studied Gandhi's philosophy of nonviolence in India. By 1968, the now Reverend Lawson had moved to Memphis, where he was pastor of Centenary Methodist Church. When the black sanitation workers struck for union recognition after two of their co-workers were crushed to death inside a garbage truck, Lawson served as chairman of their strike committee. It was Lawson who invited Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. to speak and march in Memphis. The Memphis strike was King's last battle. Memphis was where he was assassinated. Lawson went on to play other important roles in the labor movement, moving to Los Angeles, where he pastored Holman United Methodist Church and joined with Maria Elena Durazno of the Hotel Employees Local 11 and with the SEIU Justice for Janitors movement in mass organizing drives that made LA a union town. Lawson was active in the movements for reproductive and gay rights and was a strong advocate for the rights of immigrants. And just as he had been a leader of the 1960s Freedom Rides, Lawson was a leader in 2003 of the Immigrant Worker Freedom Ride, which came through Kansas City. And if all that wasn't enough, he also hosted for years a weekly call-in radio show where he discussed human and social rights issues. Historian Michael Honey made a movie a few years ago about the Reverend James Lawson called Love and Solidarity, James Lawson and Nonviolence in the Search for Workers' Rights. You can find it at Bullfrog Films or on Amazon Prime. Here's the trailer.
Our power has always been in ourselves, in our people, and in our unity, in the courage that we have to say no to racism and injustice.
The concept of nonviolence is a 20th century term coined by Mohandas Gandhi of India. Gandhi also goes on to say that love is power. It's the most creative power of the universe, and it's the greatest force, he says, that is available to humankind. And humankind needs to learn how to use it.
A laborer deserves his wages. I think wages of people who do the work is an essential ingredient of justice and of community. I think the human species was created primarily to learn to work. Physical work, intellectual work, artistic work, community work, social work. We have to work as human beings because it feeds our dignity. It feeds our sense of making a contribution. It feeds our sense of taking care of ourselves. And so all work has dignity to it, is what Martin King said.
All labor has dignity.
And so work is not primarily for wages, but we ought to be able to benefit from our work, especially the work that we do outside of the home and in the larger community.
They cannot support the simple right of the ordinary man and woman in this society to have the full dignity of their work and their wages. And we must begin to tell the Democratic Party, stand up and be counted for human rights and for human dignity.
That was the trailer to Michael Honey's movie, Love and Solidarity, James Lawson and Nonviolence in the Search for Workers' Rights. In April of 2018, Amy Goodman interviewed Honey and Lawson on Democracy Now! Here is part of that interview.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report, with our discussion with historian Michael Honey and civil rights icon James Lawson. Yes, we're continuing to look back 50 years after the assassination of Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., gunned down April 4th, 1968, in Memphis. I wanted to go back, Reverend Lawson, to why King first came to Memphis. It was as a result of a call you made, is that right?
Yes, but it must be said that when the police gassed us and broke up a peaceful march on Main Street in Memphis on February the 23rd, the community had a very hasty meeting at Mason Temple after that gassing and decided that we had to mobilize the entire community. So they selected a number of us to be on a strategy committee, and they asked me to serve as chair of that strategy committee. We met that following Monday. We began mass meetings. And as we began those mass meetings, we said, let us bring into the meeting a number of figures. And so we strategized that we wanted Bayard Rustin to come in. We wanted Roy Wilkins of the NAACP to come in. We wanted Martin Luther King Jr. to come in. And so we made assignments right then and there for the people who would call each of these men and get a date from them when they could come in. So I, of course, as a longtime associate of Martin King's from, in fact, 1955, and been with him in Birmingham in the sit-in campaign, workshops on nonviolence in South Carolina and elsewhere across the South. So I was the natural person to call him and talk to him about it. And he was instantly aware of the strike, and he agreed very quickly that he would come as soon as possible.
Reverend Lawson, when he was forced out of that first march, and March 8, the march that broke up because of violence in the march and left, what did you feel was happening within that march? And then why Dr. King, who had left, many did not want him to return of his inner circle, but he said he had to return to Memphis.
Exactly. And that's right. And this would have been his coming to the city the third time in the campaign. And because the 28th, I think it was, march that, again, was sabotaged by a variety of forces that were already operative in the South as well as elsewhere in our country. We were not sure until we began to be able to look at the pictures and the photographs of that day about the fact that it was sabotaged. But in any case, as Martin King, Martin King realized that he had to return to Memphis, and I had every confidence that he was going to make that decision, though many forces said to him, do not return. But that was for the second major march that he would have been on.
And why was he personally so committed to returning, which he did, of course, gave that speech at Mason Temple, yeah, and the next day would be killed?
Because, number one, he recognized what was going on in Memphis was a part of what I call the Black Freedom Movement at that time, or it can also be called, as Congressman John Lewis called it, the nonviolent movement of America. So he had no hesitation in identifying himself with the strike, especially with the poverty of economics, the poverty of people who work but live in poverty.
One of his great quotes on March 18th was, "It is a crime for people to live in this rich country and receive starvation wages."
Absolutely.
We could say that today as well.
Yes. You know, let's go to that clip of Dr. King himself making that comment March 18th before he left at the time of that march in Memphis.
You are demanding that this city will respect the dignity of labor. So often we overlook the worth and the significance of those who are not in professional jobs, of those who are not in the so-called big jobs. But let me say to you tonight that whenever you are engaged in work that serves humanity and is for the building of humanity, it has dignity and it has worth. You are reminding not only Memphis, but you are reminding the nation that it is a crime for people to live in this rich nation and receive starvation wages.
It is a crime for people to live in this nation.
It is a crime.
And receive starvation wages. I immediately think about what's happening right now in Kentucky and Oklahoma, well-known red states where the teachers have marched out. In Oklahoma, in many places, there's only 4 days of school a week. Fifth day, the teachers go out and do their second and third jobs because they can't make enough money. 49 of 50 states in the amount of money that they are making. Why do you think, Reverend James Lawson, that Dr. King is not remembered as much for his intense message about economic justice, his support of unions?
Do you want my frank opinion?
I do.
Okay. I happen to think that because Martin Luther King Jr. was a black man and saw racism and racial injustice and economic injustice as crimes against humanity, that it is the racist element in the United States that does not see that that message relates to the entirety of the land, and that what the CRM is called in the United States teaches too many people that that only amounts to issues for the Negro and not issues about tyranny and issues about our capacity to govern ourselves. I think it is the racist element in our society that does not accept King in Christianity, for an example, as perhaps the primary prophet, the primary preacher of the 20th century.
And this applies to those unemployed steelworkers in Pennsylvania and other places just as much as it applies to unemployed people who used to work in the cotton economy in Mississippi. These are the left-out people, the throwaway people of plantation capitalism. And this is an uncomfortable conversation for advertisers and people who like to sponsor the Martin Luther King Day events, politicians. People come together to celebrate, which they should. But bringing up these issues is about right now. It's about economic injustice right now. And it's very uncomfortable for some people to have that conversation.
And it's not it's not understood either with the many white workers who have been terminated in the steel industries, in agriculture, in all across the country and are not able now to have the income that they had in 1960 or 1970 because of the economic circumstances.
Workers everywhere should see King as their hero.
Exactly.
As their hero, a labor hero.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
What about the effect of the surveillance, Reverend Lawson, on Dr. King? These are the last days of his life, the FBI pursuit and persecution of Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yes.
How intense was it, and how was it affecting Dr. King?
Well, Dr. King knew from 1964 Nobel Peace Prize that the FBI was following him and tapping his phones in a 24-hour capacity. And he saw that as a Jesus follower. He saw that as one of the things that meant that his life was blessed because there were people who persecuted him unwarrantedly. So he lived with it. But I want to say publicly that there were governmental agencies that were vehemently opposed to Martin King and saw him as a traitor, saw him as a communist, saw him as an enemy of the people. There are executive orders that are available that indicate that the King had to be stopped. So when we talk about the assassination of Martin Luther King, I maintain that we now have the full evidence to a moral certainty beyond a shadow of doubt that James Earl Ray was not the shooter and was not the plotter or the planner. This was done by other people and other agencies.
Explain this. We just have a minute to go on the satellite, Reverend James Lawson, that you're saying James Earl Ray was not the shooter.
Yes. Well, from the very beginning, there were suspicions in my own mind from things that happened on the very day of the assassination. You must remember that as he came into Memphis the 18th of March, the threats began in Memphis itself, and many people heard of these. This became a major undercurrent. So in my own mind, I was a part of the independent investigations that was largely started by Mark Lane and Dick Gregory. They wrote a book on it. But that independent investigations continued in various parts of the country by different people.
Reverend James Lawson, civil rights icon. And I want to thank Michael Honey, the historian and civil rights activist as well, author of the new book, To the Promised Land, Martin Luther King and the Fight for Economic Justice.
That was an interview that Amy Goodman did in 2018 with historian Michael Honey and the Reverend James Lawson. Honey's movie, Love and Solidarity, shows the intersectionality for Lawson of the civil rights movement, the labor movement, and the movement for human rights for all people.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. For what force on earth is weaker than the
union?
The House
Education and Labor Committee Chair Bobby Scott held a press conference yesterday to introduce the Raise the Wage Act. And the Raise the Wage Act will, of course, raise the minimum wage. To speak about the need was Fran Marion from Stand Up KC. Here's a bit of what she said.
I want everyone to understand the impact the Raise the Wage Act will have on millions of workers like myself. Simply put, a $15 an hour will be life-changing. I'm a single mother of two teenagers, Raven and Rashad, and $15 an hour will help us keep a permanent roof over our heads, food on our table, health care, and money to send them to college. And most of all, it'll mean I can look my kids in the eye and tell them that I can give them a life better than mine.
With us to talk about it is Mark Grunberg with Washington Window on Workers. Mark attended the press conference introducing the minimum wage bill.
What's in the bill? What does it do? When does it raise the minimum wage by to 15? And what other provisions does it have?
Okay, it raises the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2025 in four steps. $2.50 this year, $1.50, and then $1 in 2025. It also eliminates the tipped minimum wage, which is $2.13, and takes those tipped workers, like the servers in your restaurants, all the way up to the straight minimum. So they would be at $15 by 2025.
Okay, and does it index to so that we don't have to go through this again?
Correct. And then after 2025, it indexes it to the cost of living. So you don't have to go through this drill.
How long has it been since they raised the minimum wage?
The last time they passed the minimum wage raise was 2007. The last increase was 2009. So that's 12 years ago.
And it's not for lack of trying, because the Democrats have been trying to raise the minimum wage a number of times since 2009 with no success, which, of course, brings me to the politics of all of this. In your coverage of this event in the Press Associates newsletter, you do a good job of explaining where the Republicans are at on this. Where are they?
Well, they're basically against it. They're listening to the business lobby, which keeps saying it's going to cost jobs, blah, 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 the same thing that studies have disproved for years. They're also listening to the far right.
Does it look like then they're going to make it very hard to pass it in the Senate? It'll pass in the House, right? But
Right. The Senate's going to be a problem because of the 60-vote threshold for filibusters. President Biden has included it in his stimulus law, but he might not be able to get it through the stimulus law. The Republicans are balking at that. In that case, they're going to have to shunt it off. That's why the bill was introduced all by itself yesterday. Shunt it off as either a freestanding bill or try to put it in something called reconciliation, which needs only 51 votes. And the benefit of reconciliation is Bernie Sanders is going to run the committee that does reconciliation, and he's all for it.
Can you explain how that works?
Basically, reconciliation is a bill that's supposed to be only dealing with budget and tax stuff, and it goes through the Senate Budget Committee rather than through other committees that where the Republicans could gum up the works. Bernie is the chair of the Senate Budget Committee now, and he intends to put it in the reconciliation bill, if he has to, by saying, look, this will actually benefit taxes. This will actually raise revenue because people will earn more money and pay more in taxes and buy more goods, and the people who sell the goods will be able to pay more in taxes. That's his justification.
So he would actually put it in something that's much bigger that the Republicans couldn't vote against. Is that correct?
That the Republicans couldn't stop with a filibuster. They could still vote against it, but no filibuster.
I see. Okay, that's very clever. Okay, so if you were laying odds on passage of the minimum wage, what would you say?
I would lay odds that it passes, because I can just see a Republican from a red state suddenly hearing from all his minimum wage workers, and there are 32 million minimum wage workers around the country saying, hey, I want a raise for the first time in 12 years.
Yeah, I know in your article you include statistics that 60% of minimum wage workers are women, and that also a big percentage of them are people of color.
Yep.
So is it going to take mass mobilizations to get these Republicans to vote for it?
In all likelihood, yes. We'll be out, like I said in an editorial elsewhere in the news service, we're going to be out in the streets anyway, because we got to push the Democratic leadership not to compromise and to push positive legislation as well.
Okay.
One
of the statistics you include in your article is that nearly one-third of all black workers and one-quarter of Latinos would get a raise if we raised the minimum wage to 15.
Yep.
Okay, one other thing I wanted to talk to you about is another article you had, Mark, about Peter Sung Orr, who Biden has just appointed to become the general counsel of the National Labor Relations Board. Who is Peter Sung Orr?
Peter Sung Orr is currently the director of the Chicago Regional Office of the NLRB. He has been a very active enforcer of the workers' rights sections of the NLRB, and he hasn't been shy about saying, okay, group of workers X should be covered by the law, whereas before they weren't.
This is to replace Peter Robb, who Biden fired a few seconds after becoming president. So I guess we can say he was a Trump appointee. I guess we could say that we're robbing one Peter to pay another Peter.
Well, we can say that Rob robbed workers of their rights is the best way of putting it.
Because he spent
all 4 years doing that.
So tell us about the case, the Northwestern University case. I think a lot of people will remember it, that this Peter ruled in favor of the workers on.
Correct. Northwestern University football players, with the aid of the steel workers, said, look, we spent so much time practicing football, and we're so secluded from the general student population at Northwestern, and they make so much money off of us, that we should be employees and be able to organize in a union. And they had actually organized themselves and held a recognition vote. Peter Sung Orr, as the regional director, sided with them when, of course, Northwestern and the NCAA and all the colleges contested that. He sided with them. The case went up to the full board, and the full board ducked, unfortunately. So college football players aren't unionized yet. So,
well, maybe that will be in the cards. Of course, this Peter Sung Orr has to get confirmation by the Senate. Do you think that Senate Republicans will have a vendetta against him because Biden fired the other Peter?
Oh, yes. The other Peter refuses to leave. He sent a formal letter back to Biden's transition people saying, my term doesn't expire till November, and my predecessor stayed around even when things changed to the end of their terms. So, yeah, there will be a vendetta, just like there was a vendetta against the NLRB when that Democratic general counsel challenged Boeing's move to South Carolina to avoid the machinists.
Well, I guess, you know, we're all going to be on the edge of our chairs. Thank you very much, Mark Grunberg. We've been talking to the famous Mark Grunberg from Union Nursery in Washington, D.C. He provides news to dozens of labor papers and now radio shows across the country. Thank you, Mark.
Right. You're welcome.
That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show is called Isn't It Time for Workers to Have Paid Leave? The Heartland Labor Forum is a member of the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Check out the rich diversity of programming related to workers and unions at laborradionetwork.org. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Bill Claus, and stay tuned for the Thursday night special. It's a racial justice special discussion about the N-word. Tune in.
Disgrace and standing side by side with working people, sweating for an earnest wage I'll never be ashamed of. So take it in stride, we've still got our pride, 'cause we are the working class and that's the place to be.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
Struggle and fight for the common.